welcome to Section 9. My name's Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy. And I went back to my Raspberry Pi project. So today we're going to be discussing SSH, changing the factory keys in my Linux distribution, and setting up a command and control server. So for those of you that don't know the project, I'm trying to do a pen testing box by installing Kali Linux on a Raspberry Pi. And I'm using a book called Penetration Testing with Raspberry Pi by Michael McPhee and Jason Beltram, and it's the second edition. So initially, when I first started the project, I installed the ARM version of Kali Linux in it, did all the updates, and did an image after I got done. Then I had to drop the project off, and now I just got lucky enough to be able to pick it up because life is no longer in the way. So the first thing that they asked me to do was configure SSH. And then I sat in there, and they give you this command that says service dash dash status dash all. And what this does, it shows you a list of services, and it has either a plus or a minus next to the service. If it has a plus, that means that the distribution that you have has that service installed. I was lucky my service was installed. So the next thing that the book told me to do, I had to remove the current level configuration so SSH will enable with all the reboots. And I did that. Then they asked me to reconfigure the run levels to ensure that SSH starts automatically. And this is where I hit my first kind of stumbling block, however you want to call it, my first issue, because the command said update dash RC D dash F SSH defaults. And the newbie in me thought, okay, I just got done removing this and now they're asking me to set it back to defaults. What does that mean? Why am I doing that? I mean, so I guess maybe I'm not understanding something. Can you explain to me what are run levels?
So run levels are a way of grouping different services and applications or software together so that when you turn on the system and you're in a specific run level, specific applications will start automatically. And so, for example, you have run level 3, which is going to be command line only. And then whatever service or application you have that's part of run level 3 is going to start when you turn on the system. So, for example, your SSH is probably part of run level 3, as well as others, because your Kali Linux box actually has a GUI. But if you were to turn that off or you were to switch to run level 3, usually when they set up SSH, it will be part of run level 3 because they want to have that for remote access. And then if you want your GUI in there, usually that's run level 5. So run level 5 will include a bunch of stuff plus your GUI. So when you turn it on, the GUI starts, you're able to log in, and then you see your desktop.
So maybe they had me, you know, reconfigure it to defaults because that may be the one thing that makes SSH start automatically. I mean, you know, I'm just guessing. I'm going to look into it at that, but it may be that's the reason why. So it's not that they were just having me set everything to factory default. That's how I was looking at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I don't remember how run levels work. It's been a while since I've actually had to mess with them. So I'm not entirely sure what the command is trying to get you to do or what happens when you run that. So we'll have to take a look at that. And then what's also kind of confusing is that whenever I try to go into Ubuntu and try to figure out what's going on behind the scenes, I have issues because there's a lot of changes that have been made, and I'm not entirely sure if run levels are a thing anymore. For your Kali Linux system, you have run levels because they're telling you to configure them. On newer Ubuntu systems, you may not have run levels. We'll have to go in there and find out what's really going on so we can kind of understand how these things work.
Yeah, one thing that I want to kind of discuss, the book that I'm using, it's really good in some aspects because it kind of holds your hands to, you know, when you're a newbie like me and it'll go, use this command, this is why you're using the command, and this is what you're trying to accomplish. And I'm okay when it does that. But then there are parts of the book that frustrate me a little bit and makes things a little bit difficult because then all of a sudden they tell you, like, for example, I'm doing my SSH, happy-go-lucky, going to my project, and all of a sudden they go, we recommend that you set up a command and control server. And they leave it at that. They don't tell you how. They don't tell you when. They don't tell you what it is. So, you know, the one thing they did say is that, you know, when you're gathering information, you may want to send it to the command and control server, so then it can be processed in there and then you don't burden the Raspberry Pi. So I'm like, okay, so at this point I'm Googling, what is this? How do you set one of these things up? And I'm finding what it is, but I'm not finding how to set it up. I mean, they talk about different commands and this, that, and the other. And again, the newbie in me is not making the connection. So I decided to move on. And the next thing that they asked me to do, they're like, okay, you need to change the factory keys. And the reason that they offer is, you know, all Linux distributions use the factory keys by default. And I understand that. But their main reasoning for it was they were saying that changing the keys would ensure that someone could not access our data to determine who planted the Raspberry Pi. So here is the project. The project for them is like, I'm creating this Raspberry Pi so I can physically go into a network and plug it in and then do my devious kind of thing, right? So what I did is that the first thing they had me do was create a new directory to store the old keys in there. And then they had me generate new keys. And they did also have me, yes?
So what they're talking about here is the SSH keys.
Yeah.
And I've seen this elsewhere where people are recommending, or you have a set of instructions that recommends you change the SSH keys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those things where, you know, you have so many things going on in IT and so many things going on with a project that I've never actually sat down to figure out, okay, why do we need to change the SSH key? So well, I don't even know why you have to do
that. They really didn't have me change them. What they have me do is create a directory and move them in there, the old keys, and then they had me generate new ones. And this is one of the things. They didn't tell me why quite, but they said that I needed to edit a file called sshdconfig. And they had me change only one thing on that file. They had me change it from permit root login without a password to permit root login, yes. And I had to have that in there. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, so on some of those things, they don't really explain everything. So I'm with you there.
So this is typical of any IT book that you get. And part of the problem, I think, with this book is that they are leaving certain things out because maybe they assume people know that, or they mm-hmm. themselves know it, and they kind of forget that others may not. And so they leave them out. The other thing is you can't include everything in a book. It would be too big.
I get that part. I mean, you and I had this discussion when you were trying to teach me, this is how you study for a cert. And I remember one time at one point I wanted to take the CCNA. And when you were looking at my book and what they were having me do, you're like, wait a minute, they're assuming that you know the basics of networking. You need to stop and you need to go and do your Net Plus first. And figure out how the network, you know, at the very basic runs. So I understand what you're saying. And like I said, the book is really good sometimes about telling you, oh, I'm doing this, is the command I'm using, and this is why you're doing it, and it's awesome. And then all of a sudden they're like, set up the command and control server, and they don't tell you why. But here's the funny part. So when I got done with this SSH and the keys, you know, I tested to see if SSH was working, and it was really exciting for me to go on my workstation and SSH into the Raspberry Pi. I was like, ooh, I did it right, and it was super exciting. And then they had me do something called reverse SSH or reverse shell. And at that time, I realized, you know, it was when I entered those commands that they had me enter, that that's how they were setting up the command and control server. It was a command they had to do. So what they did is they had me do a command. It was SSH dash little f big N dash big R. And then they had me do a port colon the local host colon and, you know, the SSH port number 22. And then they had me do, you know, the host name of the server and then the IP address, and that was the IP address of the command and control server. And they had me do this on the Raspberry Pi. And then they turned around and they said, okay, now you go to your command and control server, which I did that on my workstation, and they had me do SSH root at localhost dash little p, and then the same port that I had used on the previous command on the Raspberry Pi. And it was until this, you know, when you were taking a look at some of the stuff, because I was kind of struggling with the commands that you said to me, stop, don't do this anymore, because you don't want me to use my workstation as the command and control server in case something happens, because the commands that you were seeing were super specific. So now what you told me to do was stop doing that and redo the whole thing, create a virtual machine and do your command and control server in there. That way, if I mess it up, and then that's more relaxing for me, because then if I mess it up, I can delete it and put it right back in. It would be nice. So
yeah, let's review here for a minute, because I think there's a lot going on. And, you know, it may sound like a simple project, but there's a lot of things happening.
Mm-hmm.
So you configure SSH on the Raspberry Pi, and then you have new keys, you have run level issues, you have all these things happening on the Raspberry Pi. And then, you know, there's that scenario where you're going to be plugging this into your target organization, right? You sneak into the company, you plug this in. So what you're doing when you type in the command on the Raspberry Pi is you're making an SSH connection outbound through the firewall and connecting to your command and control server.
Right.
So that's really important. And I think that's where the exciting part comes into play.
Well, and that was some of the things that I didn't understand what I was doing until you said to me, okay, you got this firewall and you know that when you have traffic coming from the outside, that firewall is going to stop it. It's not going to let it in. So what that reverse shell that they're having me set up would do is I could remotely log into my Raspberry Pi and then send the information from the Raspberry Pi outside. So then when I go ahead and I send something from outside the network, the firewall would go, ooh, this generated from inside the network, so it's okay to let it in. It wasn't until you told me that and I went like, oh my gosh, this is why they're having me do this reverse SSH thing.
Yeah, so to clarify, the reverse shell is connecting from the Raspberry Pi outbound through the firewall and connecting to your SSH server on your, in this case, your workstation, because that's what you used for your command and control server. So then once you have that established, you walk away.
Right.
And then when you get home, you go to your workstation and then you log in to the local host where the connection is already established. So you don't have to mess with the firewall anymore. You've already bypassed that.
Right. And then you were saying something because I was curious about why on the command that I had to do on the workstation, they have me use the root localhost without the IP address.
Right, because, and this is where it kind of gets fuzzy with the different, and I think this is, to me, this is kind of interesting because this is where your network engineering comes into play with a little bit of system administration, right?
Okay.
We're talking about port numbers and connections and networks and all of that. So when the Raspberry Pi connects to your workstation or your command and control server, it's logging in with a username and password. And the connection is persistent, meaning that the connection stays there. And you have a reverse shell, meaning that SSH is sending a shell across the way to your command and control server. It's connected. So then when you type a command on your command and control server to connect to that reverse shell, it's local to the system. So localhost means your loopback address.
Oh, so that's why it already knows it's connected.
All connected. So it's a loopback address and a port number because it's waiting for somebody to connect.
It makes sense.
And you don't have to worry about the IP address because you don't need it. It's right there. It's already connected. And so now you have, and this is what's really cool, you have a setup that is almost identical to what you might see the hacker do.
Right.
Whether that's malware or that they have their own Raspberry Pi and they're putting it into this network. I mean, this is how it works. This is how hackers get in. So for example, if you have somebody trying to do a phishing attack, they want you to click on the link to download the malware and they're hoping the malware gets installed. So the malware gets installed and let's say, you know, we're going to use that as our little example here. It's installed. It now has to make an outbound connection to the outside world to connect back to the hacker. And it may do something exactly like your Raspberry Pi. It may do some sort of reverse shell of some kind. And if you use the hacker tools like Metasploit's that one where you can target a system and then attack it. And one of the things you can do is a reverse shell. So it will have malware that gets onto the system and it will do a reverse shell back to the Metasploit box, giving you command and control of that system. So this Raspberry Pi project to me is really cool because it's giving you that scenario where it mirrors the real world. This is how it works.
It's kind of interesting that their purpose is like, okay, you know, you have to go in and plug in this Raspberry Pi into somebody else's network. Of course, we're going to test it in our network, so we're not going to do that. But, you know, the more I think about how everybody approaches security, the biggest vulnerability is physical access, whether it is to an open port in the system or whether it is to the user. It seems to be like that is the easiest way for a hacker to get in.
Yeah, and I was telling you the story about my SANS instructor. The very first SANS event I went to, the SANS instructor was, you know, a professional pen tester and security expert. That's why they had him teaching the class. So he was talking about all the different things that he's done, you know, always sharing stories, and they all do that. And it's really cool when you get to hear somebody tell their story about how they do this in the real world. So for one of his situations he was working on, he was going to go and test the security of some hospital or clinic or something like that. And so he decided he was going to get a cast. He got a real cast on his arm so he would blend in. And he went into like the emergency room or some waiting room someplace, and he had his device with him that he was going to plug into the network. And he found a spot where there was a network jack, you know, your RJ45 connection to the network. And he plugged his device in and walked away. And now he's in the network. And that scenario is exactly the same as your Raspberry Pi project just talking about. You know, people do this in the real world. And as you're talking about, you know, physical security, you know, we also talked about the ports, right? So,
well, you were talking about that when you were doing your firewall, and I'm like, why are you closing all those ports? You know, I mean, if you need it for somebody to come in there, and your response was, well, if you're not using it, it doesn't do you any good to have it active because somebody can actually plug something in there, which is what this gentleman did at the hospital thing, you know?
Right. So, and I've seen this in studying for different Cisco certifications, you know, they'll have recommendations for what you should be doing. So one of the recommendations is when you set up a switch or anything that has ports on it, really, like even a firewall will have multiple ports on it nowadays. If you're not using those ports, turn them off. So on a switch, what you can do is you can set up a VLAN for ports that you're not using. So for example, we might have VLAN 2. Any port on that switch that I'm not using, I'm going to stick in VLAN 2. If somebody plugs something into it, that's okay. That VLAN doesn't go anywhere. And even if the port is active, it's not going to give them an IP address and it's not going to take them anywhere because there's nothing on that network. There's nothing on that VLAN.
Right. So I just wonder, you know, I keep thinking, why is it so common that people have the open ports or it's so easy to physically penetrate a network? You know, I mean, I think remotely sometimes it's harder because, you know, you often go turn SSH off or, you know, doing those kind of things. Don't let people go into IRC because that's how a command and control can get actually into your network. And I get that. So, but do you think that is people are not closing those ports because they like to think the best of people? Or do you think they don't know enough? Or do you think, what do you think that people, I mean, it's very often, very common thing that this is happening. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. One, I think a lot of people don't know how to do these things. They don't think about them. And so knowledge about how a network is put together, how do you work with your devices like your switch? You know, I think a lot of people don't know enough and they can't do it themselves. And I think the other part of it is they're lazy, you know, because once you start adding in security, it's more work. You add in VLANs and things like that. It you know, for some people, that's a lot, you know, ooh, VLANs. And I was talking to somebody recently about that. And they were saying, you know, in some situations, you have these people getting rid of VLANs because they think it's too complicated. We can't have this. We can't manage. It's too hard. Yeah. So, you know, when you look at what we have here on our own little network here for our lab, you know, oftentimes I'll say this is complex, and it is because we have multiple VLANs, we have fancy routing. Well, it's not really fancy routing, but when you compare it to some enterprise networks, ours is more advanced than some of those because some of them will have a what we call a flat network where it's one VLAN. Now, in that scenario, your little Raspberry Pi project becomes really interesting because if you were to take your Raspberry Pi into that environment and you plugged it into the network, you could do a basic nmap scan and you would see all the devices, all the hosts on that network, the switch, the workstations, the laptops, the Wi-Fi, even the servers, because they're all on one, VLAN. You just scan the whole thing and see everything. And so, you know, things like that begin to allow you to see why we have multiple VLANs.
And see, I was thinking about the one time that we were setting up, you were setting up your network over at your work, and you were like, I want the wireless in a different subnet. I'm like, why? You know, it's part of the network. Wouldn't you want people? I understand that now. It's on its own VLAN. Nobody can see your network. They're only going to see, like you were saying, they would only see the devices that is, you know, are plugged into the Wi-Fi and what have you. But they're never going to get past that. And that is, you know, a layer of security, if you want to call it that. But, you know, we've been doing cybersecurity training in our office, and it's been interesting because we have this guy that will send us this, and it's called like they're modules by somebody called Wombat. And then they teach you about how not to click on certain things and what have you. And one of the things that, you know, I passed mine, I went ahead and I did it. And then I get this email saying, hey, your credentials are about to expire. Click in here and make sure you log in so you can continue to use your stuff from your IT department, blah, blah, blah. So I go ahead and I'm thinking, yeah, okay, phishing email, I'm not going to do that. So we have this thing to where we can't put it directly, you know, send it directly to McAfee. And then they just take it, they sandbox it. That's what the word that I was looking for. And, you know, what I like to do is after I do that, I go ahead and I click on the email before I delete it. I will click and I will send it to my junk folder and block it so I don't get any more emails from that person. In this particular instance, I wasn't able to do that because it's telling me it's from an inside IP address. So it was actually our IT department testing me to see if I was going to bite on that. But it was like, you know, I get this phone call. It's like, you can't delete me. You can't block me. You know, it was like, it was interesting to say the least. But it is really scary how vulnerable, you know, the user seems to be like the most vulnerable thing on your network, you know?
Yeah. But again, you know, when we talk about some of these different scenarios or how do the hackers get in, you know, it's just amazing to me how this little project of yours is so, you know, real world. It's crazy, you know, to see, and you know, you're just beginning. And, you know, you got me that Kali Linux book for some of the basic tools and how it works. And I haven't gotten very far with that. But if I compare the two projects or the two books, I will say this. I think yours is way more exciting. There are some things about it that we talked about, like even in the beginning, we both struggled to figure out how do we get this installed based on the instructions that they have.
Right.
So there's no such thing as a perfect book for any IT project. It doesn't exist, which is why I've often told you, you can't just use one thing. You got to have four or five books, a couple of videos, two or three websites, and then maybe you will get enough information to make it work.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, the reason I chose it is because it said it was really basic and it was going to teach me the basics of pen testing, something that I think is important that I understand. You know, just with this little bit that I did, it's even helping me to understand SSH better than I ever thought by studying my NetPlus book, because I'm actually putting this into practice and actually seeing not only what SSH does, but how vulnerable it can be. So I'm learning the security part as well as the networking part of it. On the same token, I think your book is a little more advanced in the respect that, you know, you were working on learning your tools because you wanted to have those ready for your next SANS training. So it's more in depth about what it's going to teach you, all the many things on how to use the tool and all the commands. I think there is a second book, the intermediate one, to where you would have examples or scenarios, like you call them, to be able to do that. I think for me, this one, my purpose is I wanted to learn Linux. I wanted to learn the basics of pen testing because I don't know what it is. And I mean, I know what it is, but I don't know how it's done. I want to understand how someone penetrates your network because, you know, my dream of getting into network security is how am I going to secure the network if I don't know how you get in? You know, and once that I get in and I'm able to understand the true practical vulnerabilities of the network, then I can sit in there and say, okay, if you're good enough, you're going to get in. So what can I do to make sure that maybe I can stop you here or you don't get any further? You don't get my data out. You know, what can I do? How can I identify someone in my network and what they're going to do? So I mean, this right here at the beginning is just having me set up some of the services that I'm going to be using. Eventually, the book claims they're going to teach me attacks, basic attacks, and how to do that. So I'm looking forward to that because, but I still think that for me, still being as new as I am in IT, I'm going to struggle understanding that. I'm going to struggle understanding some of the things. And, you know, I'm lucky to have you next to me that I can turn around and go, hey, besides Google, who's not explaining everything to me, how do you put this into context? And you're always there kind of showing me that. This is something that I really like sharing with our listeners because there's going to be people like me out there in IT at the same level that I'm at, and they're trying to perhaps they undertake this project or some other project, and they don't have someone like you to say that they can turn into and say, hey, you know, tap, tap, I'm sitting right next to you. Help me out with this part of it that I don't understand. So, you know, it's a cool project. I'm super excited about it. You know, my dream was to try to be able to do it by myself. And I think the hardest part was to understand I don't know enough yet. You know, while I've done enough networking to get me to where I understand as much as I do about it, there's yet so much I need to learn and so much help I need to get or to gain so much knowledge I need to get to be able to get through some of the steps. And, you know, maybe me asking you, we can share the project and then you can enjoy it as much as I am, you know.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we have to be careful about here in any IT project that we do, when they say basic, that's relative. Right. It may be basic to them, but it may not be basic to somebody else. And, you know, we both had issues with the beginning of the project because we didn't really understand exactly what they meant. There were some gaps there. I won't go so far as to say that the book is bad, just like I won't go so far as to say that that other Kali Linux book that you got me is bad. I think they have their place. I think they are both good. It's just that you have to be willing to go elsewhere to find more information when the book fails to give you what you need. And that's where it gets difficult. But I also want to say this. You've done a lot of IT projects, and we made that kind of a focus after a while because you were trying to do book and video and thinking, okay, that's enough. I'm going to learn something. And you do learn something by doing that. The problem is that when you go to take a test or you try to set something up, now you have to apply it because a lot of the certification tests that are out there now, they've changed them. They're not, you know, yeah, it's multiple choice in a lot of cases, but it's a scenario. You have to think about applying the knowledge you have to the scenario to pick the right answer. And without hands-on experience, video and book is not enough.
Well, and that was one of the biggest challenges for me. And I think that's probably, you know, I don't think I could have passed the test even if I took it again, just doing the book and videos. And not only that, the practical experience that I have gained by doing our projects, you know, not only did it help me understand what I was doing and what I was learning in the book, but when you go into a job interview, if you're giving them the book and the definitions and the video version of it, they're going to know. They're going to know you haven't touched a device. They're going to know, what if, you know, what if somebody says to you, okay, connect this server to the network and configure me something basic. You know that the very first time that I got off the book and, you know, I had my server configuration, I was golden, I knew how to do that. And it's like, okay, how do I plug it in? How do I connect this thing physically, the physical connection, which a lot of the books, they tell you what the ports are. They tell you, you know, different things, but they don't actually tell you, plug this into that. Do you see what I'm saying? So I think if you're trying to learn IT, get a lab, start playing with it. It's so important. I never thought that I could actually do as much as I can do right now. And I busted my butt studying so many times, you know, thinking, okay, if I memorize it enough or if I actually break it down to try to understand what they're trying to say. And, you know, they have these people that go, knowledge is power, you know. I'm here to tell you, I learned this from Bruce Lee in combat. Knowledge is not power. is the application of that knowledge that gives you the power. You can read everything and know everything in the world, that if you cannot put it to practice, how does that do you any good? You know, and it's one of those things that the gap between what you're reading in IT and in applying it, it's a hard thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do. So when you're sitting in there banging your head against the wall and trying, don't give up. It's not an easy process. It's not an easy subject, and it's not an easy field to understand. You can cram for other tests and pass and survive. When it comes to IT, you can't cram it. You can't. You can look at it and try to understand it, but if you cannot actually put that into practice, cram until the cows come home. You're not going to get that job, and you're not going to pass the test because people will see right through that. I know this because I had gone to interviews and somebody said to me, what is DHCP? And I can give you the definition of DHCP, but can I tell you what DHCP does? Can I sit in there and say, hey, you know, I configure this on server 2016. Or 2008 or two, whatever, 2003. I have done this. You know, this is a service. This is what hands you the IP addresses dynamically. You know, you say that to somebody, they go, okay, she's done this. So, I mean, I went through a whole interview. They asked me what DNS was. And I told them what DNS was. And I told them what DHCP was. And I told them what ping did. And I, you know, but I never really sat in there until we were setting up the network and say, yeah, I know what ping is. You ping the IP address. And why do you do that? You want to know if you have connectivity. You ping Google to see if you have internet. You know, you ping an IP address on your network to see if you could see it, you know, to see if the connection is there, to see if you have things configured right. And when you're giving more than just the basic explanation about what you know what it is, then I think that people will understand and maybe you can get your foot in the door. That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, and that's really the whole point of all of these labs that we do in our projects and everything else, is that we want to learn, we want to understand how these things work because we think they're interesting. You know, I think your Raspberry Pi project is super interesting. I want to see where that goes. But we're also doing this so that we can get that other IT job and make it in security or some other part of IT. And, you know, the people can see some of that. You know, when I've gone for, it's a little bit different when you go for some of those entry level positions. But when you start going up the ladder and you get into these more advanced situations, they can see whether or not you know what you're talking about, because they'll ask you questions about something. And if you don't really know what that is, they can tell.
Well, and that was my problem with the Net Plus exam. I had no practical knowledge and I had read about the different things in the network. And what do they ask me? How would you do this if you have this scenario like this, that, and the other? Okay, I have never done this scenario myself. I never set up a network with that kind of a scenario. How am I going to answer that question? How am I going to know how to do something when I have no practical experience? I may know what IP address is. I may know, you know, what SSH is. And then, but if I have never actually experienced like this, I set up my SSH and I configure certain things. And now all of a sudden, what is the first thing that you always say to me right after you get done doing whatever it is you're configuring, setting up or what have you? Test it and see if it works. And what did I do? Okay, I sat down, documented how to test SSH. You know, I went ahead and I did it. And then I was able to see my Raspberry Pi. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in. This is so exciting. From my workstation. I've never done that before, you know. And it was super exciting. And then when I was doing that also, you know, from my CNC server. And I was able to see, oh my God, you know, I know what I was doing. And then there is my Raspberry Pi. I'm like right in. I'm right there. You know, so it was really super cool to be able to do something like that. And I'm excited because I think that right now, learning it this way makes sense to me.
Yeah. And so let's recap here. You know, you had to set up your Kali Linux on the Raspberry Pi. That was a bit difficult. I had some issues with that myself. And then you went ahead and set up things like SSH, new keys for SSH, making sure the run levels were good. You did your reverse shell. And that's a lot. And so I think, you know, going forward, there's going to be some even better things that you're going to do with this. And the big thing for me is that the reverse shell is what you're going to see in the real world. And the scenario is you've snuck this in behind the firewall, and now you have command and control access to a box on somebody else's network that shouldn't be there.
Right.
And there's just so many things we can talk about. We can talk about inventory control, right? We can talk about our SSH script that we have, that or not SSH, but our Nmap script, the automated Nmap script that scans the network for new devices. So things like that, you know, this is huge. I mean, there's so many things you can talk about just based off of your tiny little project that's not so tiny. You know, I think you're going to learn a lot from this.
You know how we're always talking about how we're going to run out of IP addresses with the projects that we're doing and what have you. And we've been thinking about redoing the network. I'd be curious to see if we can plug in the Raspberry Pi and then see what's all in our network and how goofy it is right now.
Eventually, when you go through this, I'm sure they're going to have you learn how to or have some sort of a project or step-by-step process for identifying hosts on the network. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how they have you do that. I mean, there's just so many things that I can see, you know, even though this is the beginning of the project, how this Raspberry Pi is teaching you so many new things and how it fits in the real world, and even how I could possibly use that for maybe not necessarily work, but, you know, other things that would help in that kind of arena.
Well, one of the things that I know that you're really itching to find out is how powerful this is Raspberry Pi is, because the Pi 3 is a 64-bit. So, you know, the one that we had before was only 32, correct?
Yes.
And it didn't do Wi-Fi and it didn't do Bluetooth, you know, and some of the things that this one does. I know for the Wi-Fi, we had to buy like a dongle or something that we had to put in there on the 2. Remember that?
I think so. There was something.
Something that we had to do extra. It didn't come with it or whatever. It didn't came capable like that. But I think, you know, I'm doing this, and I told you that I was doing this pen testing for you because I saw that on Black Hills Security for their penetration test tool, or the toolkit that they have. And, you know, I just was fascinated. Tiny little Raspberry Pi. And these people, the Black Hills Security, they're incredible security experts. If you have a chance, check their website. You may want to put it on the show notes because they have some really nice videos. They're very knowledgeable. And when I was looking at that kit, I thought, ooh, I got to make one of those for Damien because, you know, you were looking at using the tools and kind of getting all of that ready. So, I wouldn't mind doing that. And then I think that I'm probably, depends on how intricate it is and some of the things that we have to do because we have a lot on our plate when it comes to our IT. I have to get my tools ready for my job interviews to get to where I want to get. But I think if I have time, I would like to then do one for me so we can have a couple of them and then just use them on our network to be able to do the security part of it. So,
yeah, I think this is going to be good. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, we're going to be putting the commands and, you know, some of the things that I have done on this step on the show notes for you to take a look at, see if you're interested. And then we'll put the name of the book and then the Black Hills thing, right? So I don't have anything else. You?
No, I think that's it. If you want to take a look at those show notes, you can go to section9.us. And if you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.us.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.